I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Terry Tempest Williams was in her 20s when her mother died from cancer. She wrote about that loss and other women in her family who had also died of cancer in her book, Refuge. They had lived downwind from where atomic bombs were tested in the 1950s. Williams' new book is also about her mother and the 54 journals she gave her before she died, one for every year of her life. When Williams decided to read those journals after her mother was gone, she found that every page was blank. Terry Tempest Williams' new book, When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice, is about the meaning and mystery of this provocative gift. She also writes about writing, about silence, Mormonism, love, sexuality, birth control, memories, and some key episodes in her life. Terry Tempest Williams joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. A great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's wonderful to be here in Philadelphia.
Well, we're happy to have you here as well, and I'd love to begin with a reading from the very beginning of your book.
Thank you. I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. This is what I remember. We were lying on her bed with a mohair blanket covering us. I was rubbing her back, feeling each vertebra with my fingers as a rung on a ladder. It was January, and the ruthless clamp of cold bore down on us outside. Yet inside, Mother's tenderness and clarity of mind carried its own warmth. She was dying in the same way she was living, consciously. "I am leaving you all my journals," she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back. "But you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I'm gone." I gave her my word, and then she told me where they were. I didn't know my mother kept journals. A week later, she died. A month later, I found myself alone in the family home. I kept expecting Mother to appear. It was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where she said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third. It, too, was empty, as was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All of my mother's journals were blank.
And that's Terry Tempest Williams reading from the very beginning of her new book. And I have to tell you, I told several people about what this book was about and about your mother's journals, and each one of them had the very same response. Their jaw literally dropped.
As did mine.
Opening those books and seeing nothing there.
Haunting. Haunting. And it still haunts me, Marty, you know? As you said, I think I approached it, I was barely 30, and I was so stunned because my expectations were so high. I thought, finally, I can now know what my mother was thinking. She was a very private woman. But then to find every single journal, page after page after page, empty, blank, nothing. At that point, I couldn't afford to think about it. It became a second death. My mother's journals became paper tombstones. I just gathered them up, I took them home, and I began writing in them unceremoniously. And it wasn't really until 25 years later, when I became the age my mother was when she died, that I really retrieved that memory from the soles of my feet and said, okay, what was she trying to say to me?
Well, your own book here also includes some blank pages. And as I got to them, in fact, right after that reading, there are several blank pages. And I was wondering whether you wanted us as readers to experience what it's like to open a book and see no words.
Exactly. Because it's a physical response. I mean, you can hear that story, but, a book is a living thing to me. It's tactile. It's beautiful. You smell it. You see it. And I wanted the reader to be there on the page with me as my mother asked me to be on the page with her. And it is a visceral response. Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me, especially for a writer, a blank page can mean so many different things. I mean, for a writer, a blank page is something to eventually be filled.
You hope.
You hope. You know? Maybe on a good day.
I mean, it's both the terror and possibility, right. Isn't it? I have to tell you a funny story, though. My editor, Sarah Crichton, who is wonderful, and, you know, she understood immediately and said, there's 12 pages blank, which is significant. And I saw her not too long ago, and she said, Terry, we have a problem. The books are being sent back by bookstores because they think that there's a printing error. You know, what are we going to do? And I said, it's not a problem. You know, our culture doesn't know what to do with emptiness, with what is blank. And yet, I think the gift of my mother, as I've lived with this over time, is what began as emptiness has become very full.
Have you, though, written, I mean, it sounds like you have written in your mother's journals.
I did. I noticed this, however. In every one, I did first say, this is one of mother's journals. That was about it. And then I just went on. I wished I had saved them, you know, but it's so indelible in my mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you said, it began as a mystery, something to solve. And I think what I have come to appreciate is it's more than a mystery, it's mysterious. And if something is mysterious, then you can hold it as such. I don't need to solve it as much as honor it.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, I think one is always a child, even when one's an adult, certainly when thinking about a parent. And my dad used to keep journals, and I remember looking at them and looking for me. I mean, I was looking for what did he say about me?
I love
that. How did I appear in his life?
And,
you know, I was there.
Yeah.
Doing all my little shenanigans, but probably not in the way that I saw myself. You know, he was writing for himself.
And you and I were talking before on air that you have lost your mother.
I did, 10 years ago.
And
yes.
Did she leave you journals or things of her words?
She left, I have some of her things. She was a birder, like you. And I have her shoes in my closet.
Really?
So that, yeah, I have my dad's shirt in my closet. So that when I get dressed, I see his shirt and her shoes are on the floor.
What
there
kind
as well.
Of shoes?
You know, comfortable walking shoes.
Her birding shoes.
Her birding shoes.
I love that. I have my brother's cowboy boots.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
I do. And that's so interesting. I'm trying to think of what I have of my mother.
Yeah. Oh, you know, interesting. You describe her in that passage as being conscious. You also seem to describe her as a woman who was self-contained, probably private.
She was very private. She was a private woman, but not a silent one.
Right.
And she was a trickster. My mother understood drama. She was very theatrical in her reserve. Mm. When my father turned 40, she wrapped all his birthday presents in black. As I told you, she tripped Elizabeth Taylor on purpose. You know, she was really surprising.
Right.
And she understood that Mormon women write. Mormon women in my generation were expected to do two things, keep a journal and bear children. My mother did both. So I think about, you know, she knew that I kept journals. That's the only thing I've done religiously aside from birth control. And when I think about that my mother knew I had hundreds of journals, you know, from the Arctic to Africa to prairie dogs to Hieronymus Bosch to shopping lists, then I start thinking, what was my mother trying to say? And there's a part of me, Marty, that thinks this was an act of defiance.
Well, it's funny you said that because you write in this book about Mormon culture. Women expected, as you said, to do two things, keep a journal and bear children. She bore children.
She did.
Clearly. She had a journal.
She didn't, kept her journal. She just didn't write in them.
Well, exactly. And whether that was an act of rebellion on her part.
I know. And then I think, the attempt, you know, that, I mean, somehow she kept gathering these journals, and was there the hope that she would write in them? And then something stopped her. You know, my father, what can I say about my father? I adore him. I love him. But when I was talking to him about this, and I gave him the manuscript, which is always an act of terror. He just said, I do not know. I mean, what's the big deal? I don't know why you're making such a big thing of this. Obviously, she was lazy. And I just thought, no wonder she didn't write in these, you know?
To be judged, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, and then to my father's credit, about a month later, he said, I've been thinking about Diane's journals. And I think that if she had written in them, she would have betrayed everyone. And I think she was protecting herself.
As a truth teller, you think?
Yeah, because he was saying if she were to write about me, if she were to write about her children, if she were to write about her religion, from my father's point of view, she could not bear that. And so therefore she said nothing.
Well, and journals are such interesting things in that people, I don't keep a journal, but for people, I know you do, you are writing for yourself, but one must also know that these journals can be found, you know, discovered, lost, and that this private information doesn't necessarily stay private.
Well, you know what's so interesting is as children we were, you know, you're given a journal. I was given my first journal at 8 years old when I was baptized. And you are the record keeper. You know these journals will be read. And what I can tell you, Marty, is my journals are much less interesting because I think someone's, you know, going to read them, my family. So therefore, in many ways, my books are much more private than my journals.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Because I think someone's going to read my journal. I don't ever think anyone's going to read my book. You know, which
even after all these books?
I don't. And that's how strong that ethos is.
I'm curious, you said your father's first reaction was to be rather dismissive about finding these journals with blank pages. How about the rest of your family? Were they as kind of intrigued, unsettled as you were?
In truth, my family hasn't really talked about it.
Oh.
I have three brothers. One has passed. And my youngest brother, Hank, we had a great conversation about it. None of us knew she kept journals, you know, and also my brother Dan. But in terms of, you know, I don't have a sister.
Would that make a difference, you think?
I think so. And I haven't really thought about it until you asked me, but there hasn't been that much of a discussion around this.
We're almost up on a break here, but it's interesting you say that because your book is about silence. I mean, it's about many things, but you write quite a bit about silence.
I think that's a very astute point. I thought I was writing a book about voice. In truth, I think this is a book about silence.
Oh, interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Terry Tempest Williams, our guest today on Radio Times. She's got a new book called When Women Were Birds, and it's subtitled 54 Variations on Voice. And it was written in response to her mother's journals. Her mother kept 54 journals, gave them to her daughter after she died to read them. And when Terry Tempest Williams read them, those pages were blank. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Charles Dutoit, in his final concerts as chief conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, leads Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. And with Maria Joao Pires, Chopin's second piano concerto. Tickets online or by phone, 215-893-1999. This Thursday and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, a celebration of Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscowain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
The Philadelphia Inquirer proudly supports WHYY. The Inquirer recently won the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism for its Assault on Learning multimedia investigative series. News and more. The Inquirer. Your life. Your stories.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 25 years ago, Terry Tempest Williams' mother died of ovarian cancer and left Terry 54 journals, one for each year of her life. Later, when Terry went on to read them, longing to hear her mother's voice, she found that each one of them was blank. And her new book, When Women Were Birds, she meditates on why her mother might have left these journals unfilled. What did it signify to her mother? What was her mother telling her? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. You write about John Cage's silent composition, Robert Rauschenberg's famous painting, White on White. In a sense, a kind of a meditation on what your mother might have been doing. But here we have these artists who also were making some kind of a statement about sound, about sight.
Wouldn't you love to have been at that initial concert with John Cage in the Catskills, you know, where I think David Tudor sat down at the piano, opened it, and then just sat for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. A concerto of silence. And yet what we understand now is that it was anything but silence. There was the ambient bird song, there was a rainstorm, but it was viewed as a scandal in the same way that Rauschenberg's seven panels of white paintings was called a scandal of white. Both gentlemen, both artists said in each case it still frightened them.
The kind of there's the expectation of what you think you're going to see or hear, and it's dashed.
And again, it's, you know, what is white? What is blank? What is possibility? What is withheld? What is seen, felt? And I began to think of my mother, my mother's journals as a scandal of white, and that my mother also could be a performance artist, that this was her 4 minute 33 seconds. This was her...
her composition.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you said she was a trickster.
She was. And I love, you know, all the different manifestations of white. Again, emptiness and fullness.
You write in this book about yourself, I fear silence because it leads me to myself, a self I may not wish to confront.
Exactly.
Something, frankly, I could relate to.
How so?
Just, you know, silence. The need to fill it. I'm certainly on the radio. I mean, silence is very provocative on the radio. Like right now.
I live in the desert, and there is that ringing silence. It's a stillness that I absolutely have to have in order to survive. But it's not always a comfortable place, nothing hidden. And we are masters at creating distractions, sound, anything, so that silence, that stillness is filled or covered. So there, again, that's another paradox, I think, in this book, that the power of silence, the nurturing aspects of silence, the creative capacity of silence, but there's also what it means to be silenced. And I think some of the most terrifying aspects of being silenced is self-censorship.
The idea of self-censorship.
Yeah, and what are we afraid of? I love Audre Lorde, where she says our silences will not protect us. When she talks about why do we privilege fear? You know, we say we can't speak because we're afraid, we can't write because we're afraid. Well, she said, what if we were to think of fear on the same level as being tired? I mean, we all understand as women what it means to be tired, and yet still we show up for work, we take care of our children, we do what we do. And I think that that's a really powerful model. So we're afraid. Move on.
Yeah. Don't be afraid of fear.
Right. And I think that if we fail in this century, it will be because we're afraid. Huh. And we can't afford that.
This is actually a quote from your book, and it's a bit of a jump here, but nonetheless, you were testifying before, I guess, Congressman Jim Hansen and his committee. You say, Congressman Hansen, I've been a resident of Utah all my life. Is there anything I can say to you that might in some way alter your perspective on wilderness? And he looks over the tops of his glasses, and he says to you, I'm sorry, Miss Williams, there's something about your voice I cannot hear. And that's a quote.
It is.
He said that.
And I don't think he meant the microphone.
So he could not hear you, even though you were speaking to him.
You know, I think it works both ways. I think Jim Hansen was saying, there's something about your voice I can't hear. But I think what he was really saying is, there's something about your voice I cannot hear. And
is that because you're a woman, do you think?
It's a great question. I think so much of our political discourse, we are not listening to either. You know, I possibly can't hear what he's trying to say. So I think that's the other point. What does it mean to listen? I mean, really listen so that we can hear beyond the words, so that we can really perceive what is wanting to be said. So I think what my mother gave me, Marty, was this beautiful koan to think about things in a deeper way, to think about things both on the surface and beneath the surface.
So it feels like a gift now, maybe 25 years later.
It does feel like a gift. It does feel like a gift, but it is still confounding. And in the case of Congressman Hansen, there's enough, call it anger or sacred rage in me, where I thought, okay, if you can't hear my voice, maybe you can hear a community of voices. And that's where, with Stephen Trimble, a fellow writer of mine and friend in Utah, we created a community of voices called Testimony on behalf of Utah Wildlands that was disseminated among Congress. So, you know, it makes for a lot of creative thinking.
You write about a number of things in this book, including a young man named Lewis from Rwanda, who lived with you and your, I guess, your husband.
Right.
And you write in your book, everything about my relationship with Lewis has surprised me. Here's what I will tell you. And there are several pages, blank pages.
And I think in that moment, what I realized is I am, if only my mother had known that I was her sister instead of her daughter, that I understand when you have children, or create an unorthodox family as we have with Louis, there's much you don't say because of protecting one another's privacy.
Yeah.
And that's out of respect.
But you also say that Louis has improved the quality of your listening. I mean, children do that.
Absolutely.
If you're paying attention.
And brought me to my knees. And, you know, in Rwanda, there's real reasons to keep silent. It's your life depends on it, and if you tell too much, that will be used against you. And, you know, Louis has taught me the power of silence. He has taught me to listen behind the words, and also not to have to say everything. You know, I think so often we ask for things just for our own reassurance, when in fact we have to trust what our body tells us, what we know in our hearts, and respect the dignity of each person and not ask too much. It's a balance, isn't it?
It is. How did he come to live with you?
Louis was my translator in Rwanda when I was working with Lily Ye, who's from Philadelphia.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
The Village of Arts and Humanities, is
yes.
that?
Yep.
Yeah. And global citizen, mentor, holy woman. I could go on and on about Lily. She asked if I would be her scribe and join her with Alan Jacobson, who also is from Philadelphia, as you know. And we were a small team of barefoot artists that followed Lily and with Rwandans, Hutus, Tutsis, Americans, helped to build a genocide memorial. And Louis was part of that team. Long story shorter, he came to Salt Lake City 4 years, University of Utah, and graduated with a degree in political science and international relations.
So he's your son?
He is. He's our family.
He's your family. And do you have other children as
no,
well?
No. We're childless by choice. If anyone would have told me that this was my introduction into what it means to be a mother at 50, I would not have believed it. And again, that's why I love life. You know, it's presence. Mm-hmm. And again, what we can never anticipate but remain open to.
You write in this book, and this book is subtitled 54 Variations on Voice, that birth control gave you your voice.
I think that's right.
How do you mean that?
I came of age with Roe versus Wade. I remember debating abortion rights when I was in high school on the debate team. I've never had an abortion, but I know many women who have, and close friends. And I think always knowing that we had that option, that growing up in a Mormon background, I didn't have to have 10 children, 12 children. I didn't have to have children at all. That my own body was mine to control, if one can control one's life in any way. So that gave me a voice in terms of my freedom. My mother also set an example, I think. Her children were spaced. They were her choice, not my father's. She made that very clear. And I remember after my youngest brother was born, she went in for quote-unquote corrective surgery. And later she would tell me that she had a tubal ligation. What is
tubal
it?
Ligation.
Mm-hmm. Had her tubes tied. And, you know, that was not a common thing for Mormon women. That was not common among her peers.
Did her husband know? Did your father know?
Sure.
He knew.
And I think he respected that. And I have to say, it's interesting, the Mormon Church has not really formally come out against abortion or birth control. It's not like the Catholic Church. And I respect that about them. I mean, it's a very different issue on gay marriage, as you know, with Proposition 8 in California. But I think it's interesting that that is a case where there's very large families in Utah, for example. But it really was left to choice.
And that's Terry Tempest Williams, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about many things, and some of which she covers in her new book called When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice, 1-888-477-9499. But was there pressure? I'm interested that you you have one child, Louis, or Louis.
And I have to say, you know, Louis has a mother. I'm not Louis's mother. Right. But he taught me what it means to be a mother. Because there's not a day that goes by that I'm not thinking about where he is, if he's safe, if he has what he needs. My mind is now occupied. I didn't know that before.
Did you, though, feel pressure to have children?
Was there pressure
from the church?
Not from the church so much as from my community growing up in the church, certainly my relatives, you know, in those years. In my 20s and 30s and even early 40s, you know, my relatives would be, Terry, how are you? You know, and they'd look right at your stomach. My father-in-law, whom I love, would say, you know, Terry, in the beginning, we just kept praying that you and Brooke would have children. And then as we got to know who you were, we were praying that you wouldn't have children. So, you know, I don't know. It goes both ways.
That's a left-handed compliment, I guess.
So you learn, you know, what do? I think Brooke and I have been married almost 40 years, if you can believe it, and it's my great blessing. And I think the way Brooke and I look at it is that we literally gave birth to each other. Huh? And I think it's the thing I'm most proud of, because it's the most unlikely to have a long, sustained, loving marriage where you both bow to one another's solitudes. I talk about how if my mother and father's marriage was defined by their time together, I think in many ways Brooke and my marriage is defined by our time apart.
Huh? But it's still a fertile time,
absolutely. And again, you know, we're redefining what marriage is, we're redefining what family looks like. And in this book, I think I'm redefining what voice is, contemplating my mother's voice, her empty journals, and contemplating my own.
You write, and I scribbled this down, if a man knew what a woman never forgets, he would love her differently. What do you mean by that?
This is where I rely on words. May I read that
Absolutely.
Passage?
Yes. We're just passing the book back and forth across the table here.
If we can find it.
Page 96, I wrote it down.
Thank you. This is a case where It's why I write, because I can't.
You see it there?
I do.
Okay.
Because what every woman knows each month when she bleeds is I am not pregnant. Because what every woman understands each time she makes love is life could be in the making now. Which is why when a woman allows a man to enter her, it is not just a physical act, but an act of surrendering to the possibility that her life may no longer be hers alone, because until she bleeds, she will check her womb every day for the stirrings of life, because until she bleeds, she wonders if her life will be one or two or three, because until she bleeds, she imagines every possibility, from pleasure to pain to birth to death, and how she will do what she needs to do, and until she bleeds, she will worry endlessly until she bleeds. If a man knew what a woman never forgets, he would love her differently.
Mm. I mean, it's a beautiful, provocative passage.
I think, you know, and this is in that chapter that the body doesn't lie. It's about finding our voice as women through our bodies, and that making love when a man enters a woman, it's not just a physical act, but a spiritual one. So that if a man knew what a woman never forgets, he would love her differently.
Mm. I'm curious what your husband says to that passage. Did he respond,
react honestly,
in any way?
Honestly, he has, how do I say this? He just makes fun of me and just says, if a man knew, you know, I think Brooke has a wicked sense of humor. But of course he understands. I mean, it was written out of what Brooke and I know together.
But he teases you.
He teases me endlessly. It's very nice to have people in your life who don't take you seriously. You know.
Now, where do you live in Utah? What is
Castle Valley? Uh-huh. It's just outside Moab, on very near the banks of the Colorado River.
Love Moab.
It's beautiful. It's a fierce, dynamic, erosional landscape.
It's almost a lunar landscape. I mean, from someone from Pennsylvania, which is filled with trees,
it looks
that
like,
part of the world is brown. And
I think it must be what Mars looks like. And I remember I had a friend come visit us, and she was going to stay for 5 days. She lives in New York City. She stayed less than 24 hours. She was just completely terrified by the silence. There's, you know, quote-unquote, no services. So we're an hour from any market. And at about 10 o'clock, she goes, aren't you terrified you're going to be forgotten? And she's like, excuse me? And she left.
Wow. But you stay.
We stay.
You also say that you're somebody who writes about, I'm a writer about place who is never home.
That's the other paradox. You know, I think about if someone were to say, why do you write? I write to create community. But in writing to create community, you're pulled out of community. I care about these ideas. I care about Utah's wildlands. And what that means is I care about students. And one of my great privileges and pleasures is working with this next generation. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm teaching at Dartmouth. I'm away from home.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Terry Tempest Williams, our guest today on Radio Times. She has a new book called When Women Were Birds, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours, a national pediatric healthcare system. Through prevention, intervention, education, and research, Nemours has made a promise to help kids reach their full potential. This promise is lived out daily at Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, offering advanced inpatient and outpatient care in more than 30 specialties. The same specialty care is also available in communities throughout the region at the Nemours Children's Clinic. More information at Nemours.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. With proms and graduation upon us, authorities are cracking down on parents who think it's okay to serve underage kids alcohol. A Massachusetts woman has been jailed. Also, new music from Woody Guthrie's Oklahoma hometown by way of singer-songwriter John Fulbright. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The 80 social service programs supported by the Catholic Charities Appeal work to assist people across the region, like the teenager who grew up on the streets who is now a certified business software specialist, or the young woman with Down syndrome who now has a job in retail. Loyal contributors, plus thousands of new and lapsed donors, are stepping up to help in these challenging times. But the challenges of those in need are harder than most of us may ever face. Learn how to help at CatholicCharitiesAppeal.org. Catholic Charities Appeal supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Terry Tempest Williams. Let me get, looks like Abby from Northern Liberties to join our conversation. And Abby, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a graduate student in English in Philadelphia. And I just wrote a paper actually about silence and listening in Native American literature.
Oh, wow.
And I had, that's not what I call, but I had a question because I've been doing a lot of thinking about it, and I wondered, we are always privileged having a voice, especially when we discuss people of color. Having a voice is what gets you to assert yourself or garner agency and power. And I wondered what a world would look like if silence and listening were actually asserted as a medium for communication where you do get power. And I wondered what your guest thought of that.
Well, let's find out, Abby. Thanks for the call. Terry Tempest-Williams.
Abby, I think that's so powerful. And when I think about women who have held that kind of power, I think about Wangari Maathai, of when she stands with that kind of silence, knowing the wisdom of trees in her body. I think about a woman from India, Chandralekha, who was to Indian dance what Martha Graham is to American dance. I remember it was she who said that there, she thinks about a rod going down her spine that connects to the core of the earth, and that her silence can be indignation. Her silence is her dignity. Her silence is her voice. So I do think it's something, to use Marty's word, that is very provocative, evocative. And again, it's that dialectic between how we use silence and the other side, the shadow side, which is what does it mean to be silenced?
To be silenced.
Right.
Yes, indeed. Abby, thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well at 1-888-477-9499. You write about being a little girl. You had a lisp, I guess. And it sounds like you had a wonderful teacher who really helped you, I guess, find your voice.
I had a terrible lisp. And in moments when I'm very nervous, which I always am if I have to speak publicly, the lisp can return. So then you have to really slow down. What I loved about Ann Parkinson, and this was in third grade when everyone was at recess, I was in tongue swallowing lessons, is that she taught me a love of poetry. And what she did is take the emphasis away from your voice, away from you, to what you were actually saying. And in that, I lost my self-consciousness and fell in love with poetry. Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, Some Keep the Sabbath by Going to Church. You know, there's a lot of S's
yes,
there.
But you didn't think about it.
No. And I think what she did is allow me, she permitted my dignity to have a voice and not be stuck in a speech impediment.
So it wasn't as if you were going to speech class. You were going to see Mrs. Parkinson, or you were spending time with Mrs. Parkinson.
I was going through a column of saltine crackers an afternoon, you know, where you'd make it in a little ball and then your tongue would right. swallow in a different place right. and speak in a different place. Yeah, we all have those things in our background. And to this day, you know, every time I stand up to speak, I still have a quivering heart yeah. until the ideas take over. Until the poetry enters into the language. And Mrs. Parkinson, thank you.
You get nervous? I mean, stage fright?
Terrifying.
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 What, that you'll be boring, that you won't?
Well, that's certainly the worst idea, right?
Yes.
But also, always. You know, one of the things that in writing this book and thinking about my mother's empty journals, you know, what are the costs to women, particularly, if we choose to speak, if we choose to speak out. Certainly if we choose to, quote, speak truth to power. And there are real costs. There are real consequences. And, you know, that also, I think, there's a reason to pause and to think about that.
You have a terrifying chapter in this book, an incident that happened to you when you were much younger. Frankly, you were nearly killed by a man in the mountains, I guess the wilderness of, what was it?
Idaho.
Of Idaho.
Yeah, I was in my 20s. I was a teaching assistant in a field ecology class, and I did not listen. I did not listen to my instincts. Long story shorter, I was confronted with a man with a double-edged axe.
Yeah.
I can't even talk about it. A double-edged axe. And, you know, that haunts me still because I remember, I thought, I am going to be murdered. And, you know, I remember reading Barry Lopez's Of Wolves and Men, and there's a part in there about how a wolf and its prey animal, traditionally caribou, they have a conversation of death. If that conversation occurs, the caribou and the wolf have an agreement. The caribou says, I will not be taken. Or the caribou blinks and the caribou is taken. Wolves go crazy on a killing frenzy when they're in a domestic flock of sheep because that conversation of death does not occur. And I just remember when that eye contact struck, his eyes dilated to black. He was carrying the double-edged axe over his shoulders. And I thought, I will not be taken. And I ran. He slipped. And I ran for 2 miles, never looked back. Mm. Nor did I ever tell anybody.
Well, which I find so interesting. I have to say, your description there reminds me of a fairy tale. I mean, the way in the woods, you know, a man with an axe being terrified.
And I went with him.
Right.
Everything in my body said, do not go here. And I thought, no. And I went, and the fact that I never told my professor, I never told a friend, I never told anyone what I did was move everything out of the ranch house and camped miles away from everyone else. And when I looked up at those night sky stars, all I could see were constellations of double-edged axes. The next morning, I don't know how many miles I walked out of the Sawtooth Wilderness to the road and wrote my husband, Brooke, a long, long letter describing everything and, you know, with the ridiculous ending, never mind, please don't worry. But it was a physical description, everything. The man came back, and it was there he said, you thought I was going to murder you, didn't you, Terry? I mean, I have those words indelible in my mind. And I said, yes, Brooke's name came up. His eyes flashed black again and said, I thought you were a virgin. It's so terrifying. He disappeared, never to be seen again. Later, we went and did field studies up Richardson's Creek. There, we found a wikiup with the axe, esoteric birds, I mean birds, books. I can't even speak on human sacrifice. Again, everyone went, this is so horrifying. Again, I said nothing. I've said nothing until this book. And I think about what are the consequences of not speaking? What are the consequences of not trusting our instincts? What are the consequences of guilt, shame? I wonder how many women have been killed. I wonder how many women were raped because of my silence.
Oh, but you think your mother's journals gave you some courage to talk about this and even put it into a book, something you'd only told your husband?
I think it wasn't my mother's journals as much as the process of really saying, if I'm contemplating my mother's voice and why her journals were blank, what is my voice? And I think it's that myth that once, you know, aha, we found our voice, end of story. No, it's an evolution. We find our voice, we lose our voice. We give our voice away, we betray our voice. We find our voice in love, we find our voice in death. It's a constant struggle, and I think about Gertrude Stein. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, having a voice in the world is the vitality of the struggle, and I don't care who you are as a woman, however powerful you may appear to be or are, I think we all struggle with our voice.
You said that you felt ashamed or even guilty.
Absolutely.
Did you think you had done something wrong?
I thought it was my fault. I didn't want to harm his character, ruin his reputation, you know, all the things that we're raised with. And, you know, even talking to you, Marty, I'm sick to my stomach.
Sure, it's horrifying.
It's in our body. We've been talking a lot in this conversation about how our body doesn't lie. Our voice comes from our body. I mean, you are a powerful woman. You have a voice. Do you question that? Are there times where you wonder what your voice is?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in certain ways, I have the illusion that you and I are just talking.
Right.
And there's no one listening, which clearly is an illusion or even a delusion. But absolutely. I mean, and there's so many ways to use a voice to tell a story, to interview a person, you know.
And again, I think it comes back to listening, don't you? Mm-hmm. To really feel and hear what we're trying to say to one another.
Passage I underline, and not to belabor this, but just that you write about this terrifying incident. I ignored the one central tenet of every fairy tale I'd ever heard. Beware of the charismatic wolf in sheep's clothing. There is evil in the world. You can't be tricked. I mean, obviously an important lesson to learn. You know this man's name. Have you ever Googled him or
no.
to find out what became of him?
No, and I changed his name in the book.
Yeah,
and,
figured.
I wonder, you know, yeah. I wonder if he's still there. I wonder if he's listening. I still wake up at night, and I know many women have had this experience, and many women have not said anything. And again, I think about that idea, that truth, that our silences do not protect us. Mm.
I'd love to have you read a letter, and your mother did write letters. It's not as if she left a completely blank page, but you include a letter that she wrote to you on an important birthday.
September 8th, 1980, dearest Terry. I remember someone, this is not easy.
No.
I remember someone asked me many years ago what I would want most for you as a mother, and I remember saying exactly what I felt my own parents gave to me. I said, I want her to value herself and know how much she has been loved. I hope you know how very loved and appreciated you are to us. Thank you for always sharing yourself with me. I love this quote on relationships. Security in a relationship lies neither in looking back to what it was in nostalgia, nor forward to what it might be in dread or anticipation, but living the present relationship and accepting it as it is now. I feel this describes what we share so well. Terry, each woman must come of age herself. She must find her true center alone. This is such an exciting process, and you will find fulfillment and self-growth the next 25 years. If everything is right within you, nothing that happens to you can go wrong. My Heavenly Father must have loved me very much to have sent me a daughter and friend such as you. All my love, Mother.
It's a beautiful letter. I mean, what a wonderful letter for a daughter to receive.
I have kept it all these years, yeah. And it was a beautiful letter with a rose pressed inside.
Oh, wow.
It was my 25th birthday.
And did you call her mother?
I did.
As opposed to mom or mommy or
right.
mom.
How about you?
Mummy.
Really? I know, these names.
These names, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Was this a hard book to write?
You know, I loved writing this book. I can't say that about other books. I loved writing this book because I felt it was the path to myself. And I don't think that I've had the courage to speak of these things until now. I'm 56 years old. I loved writing this book because it took me a place I didn't anticipate that it would. And I loved writing this book because it allowed me to be in the presence of my mother and grandmother again, 25 years later, not as a daughter, but as a woman.
Help us understand. You even write in this book that in some distant way you are related to the Romney family.
I
don't know how all that works exactly.
My grandmother, Letty Romney Dixon.
Oh.
Mitt Romney is a second cousin once removed. He might wish it was more removed. But Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, and my grandmother, Letty, were both born in Mexico in colonial Dublon. Their families, extended families, fled Salt Lake City, Utah because of polygamy.
Right.
Polygamy was banned at the turn of the century, 1900. And then they in 1912, Pancho Villa came through, and the Mormon settlers ended up being refugees in El Paso. Each family member given a one-way ticket by the United States government to the town of their choice, and my line of the Romneys went back to Utah.
Went back, wow, to Salt Lake area. Mm-hmm. You're wearing crosses. Your earrings are crosses. What's the significance?
I spend a lot of time on the Navajo reservation, the Diné, and these were gifts. They're Navajo crosses, and I've had them 30 years, so I feel protected by them.
What's your relationship to Mormonism?
Cultural and Orthodox. A great respecter of Mormons' sense of land, community. I think so much of what I feel in terms of the power of community comes directly from my Mormon roots. I have struggled with the church in terms of their view of women, their view of African Americans, their view of Native Americans, their view of homosexuals, gay and lesbian. And I worry about this presidential election, because I think if people feel that the Mormon Church is not going to be a player with Mitt Romney's presidency, I think they're seriously wrong.
I wish we could go on. Terry Tempest Williams, we do have to end our conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for this very personal conversation, Marty. You're a beautiful listener.
Oh, thank you so much. And the book is called When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. In fact, you can go to our Facebook page and you can get to see a picture of Terry Tempest Williams. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.